Hi, this is Meg Malone, the Vermont Edition digital producer, and you're listening to the Vermont Edition podcast. This episode has been edited for clarity and brevity. Happy listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. The House Ways and Means Committee this session is taking a comprehensive look at the way that Vermont finances education. House Education Chairman David Sharp says the review is timely because it's been two decades since lawmakers have considered major changes in the current funding plan. And Ways and Means Chairwoman Janet Ansel says one of her goals is to transfer some of the tax burden from the property tax over to the income tax.
There's been a lot of interest in moving to something that better reflects ability to pay. Income is a good measure of ability to pay.
This method of funding schools, this tax support of public schools, has lasted 20 years. That's twice as long as any funding system I recall in history. And so it's due for an overhaul.
How is this approach different from the current system, and what are some of the problems it hopes to address? These are some of the questions for our guest today. We have House Ways and Means Chairwoman Janet Ansel with us, and also House Education Chairman David Sharp. Great to have you here today. Thanks for coming by.
Great. It's good to be here.
Yes, thank you.
Representative Ansel, the statewide property tax rate is projected to go up about 7% if all the budgets were approved. Does this create an opportunity now to have a dialogue to say, is this the way we really want to do it?
Well, Bob, I think the fact that we're looking at that kind of an increase probably has created an opportunity. But I also agree with Dave Sharp that this is a system we've had for 20 years. We've been hearing from people for quite a long time that they want to reduce the reliance on the property tax and move more towards income, which better reflects ability to pay. So I think there would have been the push to do this regardless. The steep increase that has been projected probably creates an opportunity and creates more interest in it. So it's something many of us have been wanting to do for a long time.
So we're going to talk about the details of the plan in just a second. But this idea of transferring some burden from the property tax to the income tax, why is that a good idea in your mind?
I think that to the extent you can have a tax that reflects ability to pay, I think that's more fair. And what moving to the income tax for every taxpayer would do is have everybody pay, at least to some extent, on the basis of ability to pay. Income is what is the money you've got in your pocket, as opposed to your investments or even your house, which is wealth, but it's static and not as accessible. So we think that income should be a bigger component of the education fund. That said, what we're talking about, actually, when we talk about the whole education fund, this income piece would actually be a relatively small piece. It'd be about probably about 10% of the total.
Representative Sharp, if you looked at the history of school funding formulas in Vermont over the last 35 years or so, you'd see a new approach taken every 6 or 7 years. I mean, I remember the Miller formula. Then there was Morse Giuliani. There was the foundation plan. There was Act 60. That was followed by Act 68. So is the normal course of events that every 6, 7, 8 years this issue needs to be revisited?
Oh, I think so. We are always focused in the legislature on making Vermont a better place to live, work, and play. And that means to pay attention to how we tax citizens and how we spend Vermont's tax dollars. And then Brigham came along and really forced the conversation in terms of changing how we did taxing for schools. So
that was the Vermont Supreme Court decision.
That's correct, yeah. It's often referred to as Brigham. And in my 16 years now in the legislature, I've seen plans come and go that have not gotten the sort of momentum needed to make progress or make changes. This year, there seems to be momentum in place to really do a good job in terms of modifying how we do education taxes.
And in your mind, are there some factors and some changes that you would like to see done?
I like the movement towards income taxes that is proposed in the Ways and Means Committee. I like the changes that bring more transparency and explainability, if you will, so that I can go home to my voters and explain how their education taxes are assessed. I think it's good. It's an improvement in terms of the tax price for communities that spend more than the base amount.
Representative Ansel, let's look at the different components of this plan. We were talking about the income tax component. It would be set with a progressive tax rate, much like the one used in our current income tax system. And this rate would not be tied to local spending decisions. So Vermonters across the state with the same income would pay the same amount of tax. And the first $47,000 of a person's income would be exempt from this new tax rate. Why is this a good approach?
What we're trying to accomplish are progressive rates, and the best way to do that is with marginal rates, where you have a lower percentage on the first X amount of income. We have a very – just to back up a little bit, I want to talk a little bit about our current system of financing education. I think we have a lot to be proud of in what we do currently. What we have currently is really quite progressive, and it does meet the requirement of Brigham, which is really an equity question for providing equal educational opportunity for all Vermont kids. And our current system accomplishes both those things. So we don't want to lose those. So when we move to an income tax, we want to be sure that that income tax is also progressive. And having, you know, so one of the ideas we've put out there is having a zero rate for the first 47,000. People need to understand how that would work. If you have $47,010 income, you would only pay that next rate on the $10. So it's the way we do our, what I'm calling now our general fund income tax. It's a marginal rate, and it basically creates a slope for everybody. That's the most fair. It allows us to keep it progressive, and it treats everybody equally.
And under that approach, renters could be affected by this because it would affect everybody's income tax. And we did have an email from Lauren in St. Johnsbury who wanted to know what would happen to the existing renter rebate program.
Our concept at the moment includes it, and I think it will stay in there. We will continue our renter rebate because the and that only is available for renters with incomes under $47,000. Their situation with respect to their rent and the non-residential rate won't change, so we'll keep that. We also did an analysis of the income levels for renters, and a pretty significant percentage, maybe 75% or so, of renters have incomes under $47,000. So they would be actually ending up with a zero income tax. And even above that, you have this marginal rate. So it wouldn't be, it'll be new, but it won't be excessive.
We also had another email questioning the $47,000 figure. What happens in households where two people are working? Does that apply per person?
We are currently, with the income sensitivity program, we look at household income, which is a pretty complicated definition, and we don't make a distinction between single and married and family. We just add all the income together. So we're basing this on adjusted gross income, which is as close as we can get to household income, hoping we can intending to get away from the household income form that people have to fill out now. So we just go directly to adjusted gross income, and we haven't settled on a particular brackets and rates and so on in the committee. We're still doing a lot of work on that right now. But my expectation would be that we wouldn't distinguish between single and married taxpayers. The only issue that we've identified is that if you are married filing separately, you would be able to and you both made $46,000, you would be able to both pay at zero. So we're saying if you're married filing separately, you only get exempted for $23,500.
Let's go to our callers. A lot of interest in this subject today, and start with Irv in Norwich. Hi, Irv. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I strongly support a shift to an income tax, but I do not understand how anyone can say with a straight face that depending on a property tax that's related to school spending preserves equal access, equal opportunity for communities of different levels of wealth. I think this is a terrible move. I think that the income tax driven by schools should have a component that depends on the local spending decisions. Otherwise, we're going back to the same cynical structure that we see in New Hampshire, we see in the social history of northern New England, where in communities of limited wealth, the privileged are able to maintain poor levels of education by forcing people who can't afford it to choose between their property tax and their children's education. And that would be a tragic step backwards for Vermont.
Irv, thanks very much for your phone call. We got a couple of emails on this subject as well, wondering if this plan is in conformance with the Brigham decision. David wrote us and said, this sounds way too complicated and is likely to run up against the Brigham equity requirements. We also, from Dan, wanting to know, does this not violate Brigham? And how are lower-income residents in high-spending districts protected? Representative Ansel, is this in conformance with Brigham?
We believe that it is. It's a really important question. I don't want to dismiss it, and I'm glad that people are asking it. We've taken testimony in our committee, particularly from our own legal counsel, about this proposal or proposals that are similar to this in Brigham, and the opinion is pretty clear that this is in conformance. Brigham requires that that towns be able to raise the same amount of money for the same tax rate. And this plan does that. There still will be, one of the other components of Act 60 and 68 and of this proposal is local control and the importance of local control. Voters can decide that they want to be taxed higher and spend more. And this plan also preserves that. Back when Brigham was first decided, there was discussion about having the state say, this is all you can spend to the towns. And I think quite rightly, people decided that was a bad idea and that voters in their local communities should be able to decide how much to spend on their schools. So this is absolutely, I believe, consistent with that.
Representative Sharp, the second part of this plan, so the first part as we've been discussing is the income tax. The second part is still using the property tax and tying that property tax rate to local spending decisions. Why is it important for voters to see that? Can't they see that now?
Well, it's too complicated a system. I think it's I'm going to talk about income for just a second because we already have a fair amount of income tax coming into the education fund through the transfer from the general fund, and 2/3 of our citizens pay their education taxes currently based on income. Although that's an incredibly complex process that we've put forward, a separate form that, different kinds of income, what's the value of your home related to that. It's figured on last year's income and applied to this year's property. It's cumbersome and problematic. So this notion of separating the income tax piece from the property tax piece is really one of the best features of this plan. Then to move to there is the property tax component still that uses the denominator. In the past, we've used a denominator that is what we call the yield. So how much money will a dollar raise in a statewide property tax? And then we have to figure out some subsidies that we spend out of that. And then we have a yield number. And then we take the per pupil spending in a district, let's say it's $15,000, and let's say our denominator is $10,000. So it's 1.5 times the base property tax rate, whatever that is. This bill changes that base calculation amount. So if you spend $15,000, the base calculation amount is $5,000. So now it's three times the base rate. So what this does is it reduces the subsidy for communities statewide. Our current system subsidizes on average across the state 50% of any spending over the base. So the tax price, which is referred to as by tax experts, is cheap. And so the belief is, whether it's right or not, the belief is that that leads to greater spending because you get 50-cent discount on every dollar. This proposal says on average across the state, communities will pay 100% of the spending over the base. And so the tax price on average will be zero. It preserves Brigham in the sense that you're going to spend proportionately more for the more that you vote to spend in your community.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to John in Richmond. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hello, Bob. Hello to your legislators. I'm concerned that, once again, we talk only about funding, and I have yet to hear anything that addresses the quality of the education that we provide to the state's children. I don't hear anything in this plan up to this point regarding how we are incenting school districts to seek out best practices, to change how it's delivered. It's once again we're addressing funding, and apparently funding only. If we can find non-financial ways to improve education, shouldn't that be at least an equal priority, if not the first priority? And then go around funding what is an overall improved system. It seems like we're taking the chassis of a Model T and we're trying to put airbags on it. At some point, the system is going to collapse under its own weight.
Okay, John, we appreciate your phone call very much. Interesting topic, very important question, Representative Sharp. We've gotten a number of emails on this subject, too, of people saying, hey, spending is the problem. We're losing students. We're spending more money. A lot of people have referred to it as rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. What about that concern?
So as a part of Act 46, we have heard this concern that we're spending way too much money on schools, so on education. So as a part of Act 46, we commissioned what we referred to as an adequacy study, and Pikus and Associates, who've done this study in more than 20 states across the country, looked at our spending. And they said, we spend about $30 million too much in administrative costs, which we hope is being addressed by Act 46 and the consolidation of administration across the state. And we've already seen some reduction in administrative costs. Secondly, that we spend about the right amount of money on K through 12 education. We do spend highly. We also have high results. So we have a high quality education in the state that we can be proud of. Thirdly, they said we spend about $140 too much in special education. Our committee took that seriously. We had UVM do a study about how we funded special education, and we had district management group work with 10 supervisory unions in looking at best practices, and couldn't we do a better job delivering special ed services to children in a cost-effective manner? And UVM looked at this, and they said if we made this cultural shift in how we apply best practices in our schools with regard to the DMG study and our special ed work in schools, we could save between $70 and $80 million. So we're embarking on that. I expect to get a bill out of our committee that will move us forward and change the funding formula and bring best practices to schools around special education.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Today in the program, we're looking at a plan that the House Ways and Means Committee is looking at to change the way that Vermont finances education. With us today, the chairwoman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Janet Ansel, and also the chairman of the House Education Committee, David Sharp. Love to get your thoughts on this subject. 1-800-639-2211. Representative Ansel, we've gotten a couple of emails from folks who say shifting to the income tax, great idea. They love it. They want to go all the way.
Right.
They don't understand why the property tax is involved at all. Why not just have, and there's a, I think Senator Polina has a proposal in that says everybody throughout the state pays based on their income, and the rate will be set to some degree by local spending. So if your community spends way above the average rate, then your income tax rate is going to be higher, too. What about that approach?
Well, one of the things that we look at when we look at financing a system as big as our education system, we're talking about $1.6 billion, is the volatility or stability of the different sources of revenue. Property tends to be pretty stable, income a little less so. One of the other ideas that we've been including in this discussion, we haven't mentioned yet today, is to eliminate the general fund transfer and instead have all the sales tax go into the education fund. Sales tax, again, is relatively stable, but there are other issues with sales tax. So our goal is really to make sure that we have a diversity of sources of revenue so that we are sure that we have enough money to make sure that we can fund this $1.6 billion in probably growing enterprise. And it grows sort of at least, you know, just because inflation grows. And we can talk about cost containment kinds of issues. But even a really successful cost containment effort is at the margins. So I feel that moving entirely to income has that problem. The other problem I want to mention is that I haven't been able to figure out how you would have an income tax that varies by local spending decisions. People tell me, oh, it's easy, just do it. But when you think about it, your house is located in a town, and you know what that town spends. But although income is not as easily sort of fixed to a particular community, and I think the sort of implementation issues in having a income tax that's adjusted by local spending decisions is really problematic.
I would just add, if our goal is to tax our citizens fairly based upon their ability to pay, that includes all three tax schemes, income, property, and sales. Abandoning any one of them skews the results in terms of ability to pay.
Representative Ansel, you mentioned the general fund transfer to the education fund. I'm going to guess that a lot of our listeners are unaware that that even happens. How much money are we talking about?
Well, we are talking about $322 million currently, and that's an amount that grows, increases by inflation. It's a substantial amount of money. And our purpose in eliminating that transfer and putting all the sales tax into the education fund is to kind of get away from these annual fights about what belongs, you know, in the education fund, what belongs in the general fund, shorting the general fund transfer a little bit in order to balance the general fund. And I don't think those fights are you know, very much sort of inside baseball, if you will, but they actually really matter because they really affect real programs. And so we'd like to reduce that tension between those two funds to the extent that we can, and eliminating the transfer is a significant piece of that.
John wrote us from South Stratford along these lines saying, most people don't realize that the education fund is no longer dedicated to funding K through 12 education as originally intended in both Act 60 and 68 during the Shumlin administration. It was expanded to include a host of other educational programs. Last year, teachers' pensions were moved from the general fund to the education fund, as well as resulting in over $46 million in expenditures to the education education fund. That's also a problem?
Yeah, it is, and it's a great point. Part of this, what I call this general fund sales tax swap that we're looking at, would move things like adult education and literacy, flexible pathways, rent a rebate, Community High School of Vermont. These are expenditures out of the education fund that are really not K through 12. And so we would put the responsibility for those in the general fund. And our goal is to end up with equal dollars going to both funds and then have the funds operate as independently as we can.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Dan in South Burlington. Hi, Dan. What's on your mind today?
Yeah, I'd like to talk about tuition dollars, public tax dollars going to fund private school education. And if we look at cost containment, I think one of the things to think about, you know, right now we've got a situation where, you know, $15,000, you know, per year per student goes to the tuitioning system, and people are sending their kids to private schools with everybody's tax dollars. Now, I understand it's a legacy program, and there's the traditional large academies, which were originally established, quasi-regional high schools. But over the time, the abuse of the system has grown, where we've got people sending their kids to go to.
Well, we lost Dan, but Representative Sharp, some concerns there about the tuitioning system and whether or not it should continue.
Absolutely. It's when you try to run a private school system and a public school system parallel, it turns out to be expensive. To the extent that our independent private academies function as public schools, I think they're an important piece of our K through 12 education in Vermont. But to the extent that families take vouchers to Phillips Exeter or St. Paul's or Kimball's Union Academy, or we know we actually support with tax dollars some students in Sweden and Argentina, this becomes a really big problem when we have Vermont taxpayers paying for private education around the world. It's difficult to change the system, I have been frustrated so far in doing that, but that doesn't mean that it's not on my list of important pieces.
Let's talk to JC calling from Berlin. Hey, JC, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on. So my quick question is about taxing the true one percenters. I have a friend who was worth tens of millions of dollars. He bought a lot in Shelburne, paid cash, built a house on it for cash, but he showed very little income. So he was getting income sensitivity on a $900,000 home in Shelburne when he was worth millions, which kind of baffled my mind. And, the true one percenters are very seldom in Vermont. They're usually living somewhere else and sometimes have a second home in Vermont. And I'd love to see some kind of luxury tax on second homes in Vermont that are worth more than $1 million or $2 million or something like that. And thank you very much. I appreciate your answers.
Okay, JC, thanks very much. Representative Ansel, what we have not discussed is the non-residential rate, second home rate, commercial rate, business rate. How does your proposal deal with that?
The non-residential property tax actually contributes about 41% of the total to the education fund. And the estimate that we have for fiscal 19 for the increase in that tax is not changed by this proposal. We've been looking entirely at the 27% of net homestead property tax that goes into the education fund. So actually, when you think about sort of the scale of what we're doing, although moving to the income tax, we're talking about a lot of money, and it's a big change, but it's a relatively small portion of the total. Non-residential property taxpayers, unless somebody has a good idea that we haven't seen yet, will have an increase to the fiscal 19 estimate, and I think it's probably, right now it looks as though it might be 9 cents or so, 7%. Can I jump in and say something that you haven't asked. I don't know how much longer we're going to be on this program, but I want to say to the people who are listening and the people who are calling in and people who've written to me and people who've written to you that this has been one of the healthiest discussions about one of the most important things that we do is to raise money for education. And I just want to say thank you to all the people who are really putting a lot of thought and time in this. When we started this work at the beginning of the session in the Ways and Means Committee, I didn't know where we were going to go with it. I had no idea. And I feel like we're coming to something that may be a real improvement on what we have. And I think it is so important that so many people around the state are engaged in this. So I had a moment, so I was going to say it.
Thank you, Janet. If I could just comment on the last caller's concern, income sensitivity goes away with this proposal. So this individual that he speaks of will not be getting a large income sensitivity check. The problems with hiding income or that wealthy people are able to do, that doesn't go away. That's true about our income tax. But he will be taxed on his property fully.
Representative Sharp, we got this email from Dan, who said, it seems to me the biggest losers under this formula will be poor taxpayers in high-spending districts.
So we've been looking in our committee, and the reason why we haven't come out, we don't have an actual proposal with dollar amounts on it yet because it's actually been hard work, is to try to find a way to ensure that the combined income tax and homestead property tax that's paid by different groups of taxpayers. I'm looking, for example, at people with just a gross income of $10,000, under $10,000 to $20,000, $20,000 to $30,000, and so on, is roughly what it is currently. We don't want to take any particular tax payer group, particularly at the lower end, and have them end up with an additional burden. And it's tricky to do. We are working very hard, and we're really committed to doing that, particularly for the lower income taxpayers.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Today, we're looking at a plan being considered in the House Ways and Means Committee to change the way that Vermont finances education. With us today, the chairwoman of that committee, Janet Ansel, and also House Education Chairman David Sharp. Let's turn to Jen in Hartford. Hi, Jen. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. I wondered if your guests could speak a little bit more about special education and best practices and how this proposal or other ideas may affect that or not. I have a medically complex, behaviorally complex elementary school student, and we've just been so appreciative and amazed at the level of services he's received from the school, even though academically he doesn't and never will qualify for an IEP. And so I'm wondering if best practices often means reducing staff, because at times he has needed a one-on-one, even though he doesn't have an IEP.
Jen, thanks very much for your phone call. And Representative Sharp, we also got this email from David on the subject of special education. David wrote us, special ed funding is almost entirely out of the hands of local school boards today. Even at the supervisory union level, it's a source of uncertainty and potential budgeting chaos because large expenses can shift when a few students move from one district to another. Would it be better to create a statewide universal budget for special education and then give students with special needs greater choice in identifying the school that best meets their needs? Two different approaches on special education. Your thoughts?
So there's about 15 questions embedded in those two comments. I'll try to address some of them. First of all, whether or not you have an IEP. So we tend to identify more students with IEPs than other states. And the national average is about 12%. We're at about 16%. We're hopeful that this improvement to how we fund special education will allow schools to deliver more services to students at risk who might eventually qualify for an IEP if we do nothing, but to be able to deliver services to those children, like the caller mentioned, her child did not yet have an IEP and was getting services, that we hope that that will be enhanced, that that work. Secondly, I would say there are two examples of what the problem that's been brought to us in terms of best practices. One is the tradition in Vermont, partly because of our funding system of reimbursement, is to work one-on-one with students with IEPs. So we typically would have a speech and language professional work with one child at a time. Best practice, we're talking speech and language here, best practice is for a speech and language professional to work with four or five students. If you have that kind of process, you cut costs dramatically and you get better results with students. The second thing is that because the documentation, we have a reimbursement process that reimburses every dime you spend on special ed. In order to make sure that that isn't overused, there is heavy documentation and time studies and whatnot that schools have to go through in order to justify their spending on special education. And you have to have a special educator work with a student in order to get reimbursed. So if a student is struggling in reading, for example, if you have a reading specialist work with that child who's not certified as a special educator, you can't get reimbursed for it. If you have a paraprofessional special educator work with that child, you don't get the reading expertise you need, but you do get reimbursed for it. That's not good practice. And we need to facilitate local supervisory unions to deliver best practices.
Let's turn to Tom, who's calling from Barnard. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I'd like to call in opposition to transferring the school tax burden to the income tax.
Okay. Why?
Well, you know, when it's based on your property tax, you can look for a house that you can afford based on the taxes and your mortgage payment. And you can set your baseline and then work your rear end off to try and get ahead. When you put everything on the income tax, every dollar you make is going to be taxed for a failing system. You know, we have a lot of people in this state with vast wealth and low income that seem to get all the tax treatment in this state, where the people that work for a living really kind of get beaten up by the legislature.
So, Tom, this plan, just to be clear, doesn't transfer everything from the property tax over to the income tax. The idea is to reduce the property tax burden by about a third. Does that make a difference?
Right. Well, no, because you're still now double taxing. You're just switching it to the income tax, which really falls on the working class, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, certainly wages are subject to an income tax, but the advantage of the income tax, in my mind, is that it also taxes unearned income, you know, interest and dividends, capital gains. There are other kinds of passive income. They're all subject to the income tax. So when we use adjusted gross income as the base, it's the sort of broadest definition of income. It doesn't single wages out for any inequitable treatment. So what we really want to do is we want to make the base as broad as we can. And the caller has a good point if we were moving everything to the income tax. But we will continue to have a non-residential property tax that brings in over 40% of what we need for schools. And we'll have a homestead property tax, which will be smaller than it is currently, but will continue to exist. So out of the $458 million that we raise from homestead property owners, about a quarter of that would shift to the income tax under the current modeling that we're doing.
Let's talk to Julie, who's calling from Chittenden. Hi, Julie. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. A whole bunch of points came to mind, but one is, since our system is, I think, perceived as good nationally, I think we should be very careful, and I know you're working hard to keep it that way and improve it still more. But, you know, Governor Scott just the other day was promoting young people and families moving to Vermont to bring wealth and success to us, and they're going to shop for education. You know, they want the best schools for their kids. And so I think It's a hard place and maybe not a great place to cut corners. It's our future, and it's, you know, we all say we believe in our children. They're the most important things to us. And so, you know, that investment, of course, has many returns in the long term. So just saying.
No, I think it's a really, really important point that we know that people move to the state, in particular young families with kids, because our education system is a really, really good system. The proposal that we're looking at the moment is not focused on cutting corners. It's there's been some conversation about how we improve the way we address cost containment. The Education Committee may do some additional work on that. In the Ways and Means Committee, we're looking almost entirely at who pays and how to make sure that the system of deciding who pays for this $1.7 billion effort is as fair as we can make it.
Representative Sharp, we're running out of time, but the governor has said he's interested in the proposal being developed at the Ways and Means Committee, but that it can't be considered in isolation. It has to be considered with other plans to reduce spending. He has a couple of plans out there, staff-student ratio. He also has a plan that, depending on how much a community spends on education, that their budget growth could be capped in the future. How likely is it that your committee is going to address one of those issues in the next couple of months?
Well, according to PICUS, and you don't have to believe everything they say, but I think that they have the credibility to pay respect to what they've recommended, and they say the savings is in special ed. My committee, all of the members of my committee labeled it as the number one priority that our committee needs to work on, and we are. We must deliver better services to special ed eligible children, or more importantly, to children at risk, especially at early ages, so they never get to having to have an IEP designation, and we can save money doing it. That's where my committee's focused. I think there's also money savings in the new calculation of property tax rates that's included in the Ways and Means Committee proposal.
Representative Ansel, just very briefly, what's the next step? Where is this plan going?
We're continuing to work on the rates, you know, making sure that we come up with the fairest income tax rates in our committee. We'll definitely do public hearings. I don't know whether we'll do them around the state or whether we'll do them at the State House, but there will be opportunities for people to weigh in. We continue to encourage people to let us know what they think, either through your legislator or directly to us. Assuming that we come to an agreement in the committee, we'd vote the bill out. It will then go to the Education Committee. I think it probably also has to go to the Appropriations Committee, and eventually, if it passes the House, it will go on to the Senate.
What's the likelihood in your mind that this bill will reach the House floor this session?
I think it's pretty good. I don't know how to handicap that, but I think it's pretty good.
We'll certainly be following this issue as it works its way through the legislative process. Many thanks to our guest today, House Ways and Means Chairwoman Janet Ansel and House Education Chairman David Sharp. We appreciate you coming by very much and having this discussion.
Thank you very much for making it happen.
And you're welcome. It's always good to communicate with Vermonters.